Welcome to the Of Interest podcast. My name is Dan Brunskill. All eyes have been on Silicon Valley Bank this week as it became the first major US bank to fall under the weight of higher interest rates. To talk about how financial markets in general are adapting to the higher interest rate environment, we're joined by Greg Fleming, the head of global diversified funds at Salt Funds. Thank you for joining us.
No trouble. Hi.
How are you doing this morning?
Well, thanks, Dan. Yes.
Okay, so I want to start with a question that I have thought about a lot, and I think I know the answer to. And with the benefit of hindsight, looking backwards into 2020, 2021, were we in a bubble? Can we call it that?
I think that we had an extraordinary amount of money sloshing around after COVID triggered that super stimulus, not only fiscal stimulus, but also central bank stimulus with monetary policy. Both came at the same time. So, you know, there was an unprecedented amount of liquidity unleashed into the world. Central bankers now defend that by saying, well, the counterfactual would have been much worse. You know, had we not done that, there would have been an appalling sort of failure and a recession that was borderline depression. We'll never know if that's true or not. But what we do know is that that amount of money sloshing around the system had to find homes. And many markets took that money. Some are as solid as just residential property, others as ethereal as Ethereum, if you might, you know, put it, coin a phrase. So the money that central banks pushed out there did create several parallel bubbles all at once.
Right, yeah. I sometimes call it the everything bubble.
Yeah.
Not just financial markets, but like prime minister popularity and demand for almost everything sort of went up, including in New Zealand, like trust in communities, and it's almost like a little bubble of everything.
Euphoria in action.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And it does feel like it is now collapsing. So I guess the follow-up question is, if we had a bubble or many parallel bubbles, have they all popped? Where are we at in that deflation process?
I think it's a slow leak, you know, and it's been a slow leak since the top of the equity market at the very, very beginning of last year. The 3rd of January was the peak, actually. And we've had a kind of staircase down since then into bear conditions in the earlier part of last year, which was a greater than 20% decline. And then a lot of kind of uncertain trading in a range around that bear trigger level since then. Times there have been recoveries back up to, you know, about 5% decline from the peak. But then we've moved back down again as new news has come in and interest rates have risen. So the slow deflation process is uncharacteristically long for a bear market adjustment, but I think the circumstances are really unique. We haven't had this exact mix of circumstances before, and markets are struggling to reprice these factors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess the famous thing that happens in a bubble is capital is misallocated. People put money perhaps where there is not as much value as they think it might be. I mean, you're the one who named Ethereum, not me, but you could also point towards tulips. Yes. Do you think that has happened to a degree, that a lot of money has chased things that are probably not going to work out in the long term?
Well, it's great you mentioned tulips, because that's a historical reference, you know, the tulip mania in Holland. I was even going to make an older historical reference, and you've given me license to do it.
Please.
Which is the silver flood into Europe from the Latin American possessions of Spain in the 16th century. Mm-hmm. You know, this was the first time we really saw inflation in a big way in history. Prices had been stable right through the Middle Ages. Now I'm going to be a professor here. But, you know, once those mines started pumping out silver, this whole new source of wealth came into Europe. And it had come out of nowhere. It had been essentially magicked up from the point of view of a person on the street in any European city. Now, the money that came into the system after COVID shock was also magicked up to some extent. You know, there was a lot of printing, there was a lot of quantitative easing, and this money was not being taken from other parts of the economy. It was coming into existence by fiat because of these emergency measures. So that sort of money supply is very inflammatory. It's red hot, and unless there are other parts of the economy that can chill the inflation impact of that, you are going to see inflation. I think the surprise is the persistence of inflation. That surprised central banks. I don't think it would surprise people, though, who were old school monetarist economists who thought, yes, like Milton Friedman's school of economists saying, you know, inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon. There were some smart thinkers after that who said, no, that's no longer true. But I think we have had his vindication.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you compare what happened in the Middle Ages to what happened now, all of this magicked up money, so to speak, has to go somewhere. It did flow into a lot of speculative things. And I'm trying to lead us into Silicon Valley Bank here. It seems like the collapse of that was because there was so much money flowing into it, which abruptly stopped.
Yes, Silicon Valley Bank, it's obviously right at the heart of that golden, transformative, disruptive, you know, move fast and break things story that's been so trendy over the last 5 years or so. And it's an innovation culture. The problem is there are some fundamental things in finance that can't be innovated away from, and one of those is interest rates and the exposure of your capital base if depositors flee all of a sudden. So maybe it's early to say, but regulators are looking at that particular bank. It's possible that they took some risks that other banks didn't for, you know, idiosyncratic reasons. Mm-hmm. But I think it's fair to say, with these new economy trading plays that have become very, very popular in retail particularly, you find that people are willing to close their eyes to some fundamentals, mm-hmm. Or might not even be aware of those fundamentals. Because if something is bound up with a very trendy or compelling or meme-influenced story, people will be drawn into it and not necessarily feel the fundamentals are necessary, or they may actually say that things have changed, whereas in fact they haven't changed, because those basic liquidity and solvency points can't be innovated away from. You know, we have a system now where money flows globally through the blockchain as well as through conventional payments mechanisms. And those are innovations in the plumbing, but they're not innovations in the source of liquidity and what it does if it dries up.
Mm-hmm. So do you see Silicon Valley Bank and its collapse being a product of the bubble and then a victim of the bubble popping or deflating?
Yeah, I mean, you can. The blame should be apportioned, I think, equally between some of those innovators in the finance space, but also the compulsion that people have been under, banks particularly, to hold a lot of government debt. I mean, this dates even far back to the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. Because bonds, sovereign bonds in particular, performed solidly through that time, then we had this wave of regulation upping the risk-weighted, you know, holdings that a bank must have in the government bond markets in order to meet all its tests that regulators put it through. So this is a classic example of generals always fight the last war, that old saying. You know, the generals in the financial regulatory authority said, aha, we can force banks to be less risky by forcing them to base themselves on government sovereign debt because it's not so volatile. Mm-hmm. Trouble is, the next war is never like the last war, and different factors come into play. And so, yes, we've had huge volatility in interest rates. Those reserves and those capital pools in the banks were not built to survive that. And some now the markets are going combing through banks across the world and differentiating the ones that did know how to diversify and those that didn't.
Mm. Yeah. It's I can't think off the top of my head the number of basis points that interest rates have gone up in the past 18 months, but it is pretty unprecedented.
Yeah, it's over 400 in the US, and that's the fastest tightening cycle that there's been. It's not the largest, but it's certainly the fastest. So that scale of interest rate increase over such a short period of time has really unmoored some investment strategies of financial intermediaries.
Yeah. I want to get into that in a second. But before we do, wrapping up the banking, you were a banker yourself? You were a Swiss banker?
I was. I was a New Zealand banker before that and a Swiss banker for about 10 years and back to New Zealand where I'm in funds management now. Yeah. But in the banking side of things, always investment management and private wealth management rather than that transactional side of the ledger.
Okay.
Yeah. But you see what goes on in these big diversified banks. They are incredible in terms of the diversity of teams and what people are working on, but also the drives for profits can force people into bigger risks than is probably prudent. Yeah.
So I guess what I want to ask is does this feel like a brewing financial crisis to you, or is this idiosyncratic stuff going on?
The best way to put it is that the collateral quality is so much better and so different now. In 2007, after the fall of, you know, Northern Rock and then Landesbanki in Iceland, all those canaries in the gold mine that then led on to Lehman Brothers and the big meltdown, people went in and said, well, what are these loans collateralized with? And of course, they often found they were collateralized with junk, mortgage-backed securities pools that were sliced and diced and all this sort of thing. I won't go back through that. Now, the collateral is actually high quality. It is the sovereign bonds. That's a claim on future taxes for, you know, the next eternity. And goodness knows future taxes are going to be high. I think there's no doubt about that. But it is enforceable. So the people looking at what's left in the weaker institutions at least know the collateral is good quality. Also, the Fed, in a couple of quite innovative moves, has now decided to lend based on the par value of those bonds to banks that hold them. So the problem caused that happened in the US, in Silicon Valley and in others, is that they had taken big mark-to-market losses on their bond holdings as interest rates rose. When they sold them into a market that was already hawkish and prepared for Fed rate rises, they had to sell them at quite big losses. Now, those bonds, if you hold them to maturity, wouldn't have been a problem at all. They would have been priced at 100, which they call par. You get your money back, what you put in, plus the interest coupons in between. Now, what the Fed will do is it will lend to the banks that need liquidity at as if those bonds were still worth 100 each rather than 80 or 75, whatever they may be worth at a market price. Mm-hmm. So that's been enormously helpful.
Got it. So instead of selling a bond at a loss, you can finance the bond at its eventual value.
Yeah, pushing it forward. But, you know, that's in a way been the formula ever since the GFC. You use a new kind of debt to postpone the impact of an old kind of debt, mm-hmm. and you roll the whole thing forward. It's not a resolution, but it's a deferral, and it prevents these sharp, sharp, horrible crises happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So it sounds to me like you're saying we're not going to have a total collapse of the international banking system?
It doesn't look likely, Dan. I think that, you know, people, again, are looking for the trouble where trouble last erupted. Mm-hmm. And so if a bank has a problem, they look back to 2007 and 8 and say, this is a bank issue. Now, a lot of the more speculative assets in the world are not really held in the banking system anymore. Many of them are in, and it's no great comfort, but they're scattered through pension funds throughout the world. Or people who have been forced to seek higher yields or higher returns because bank deposit rates were kept so low for so long. So there are no doubt speculative instruments out there that are very vulnerable, but they're not in the banks anymore. They're right through the system, and I guess that's a diversifying feature. But people who were encouraged to seek higher yields may not have actually enjoyed those higher yields for so long because some of the underlying assets are getting illiquid again.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Okay, well, let's talk about that because wealth management, that's your world, and the interest rate shock has changed the way that works as well.
Yes.
So can you talk to me about how investing and how portfolio construction has changed for you even in the past 3 years?
Yes, I think that, say, if we look back 3 years and you're constructing a portfolio from scratch, one thing you would see is horrifically expensive bonds everywhere that look like an accident waiting to happen. And that was because of quantitative easing, mm-hmm. and because of regulation that had forced people to hold them, a whole lot of reasons. So you would have kept your bond allocations to an absolute minimum, which is what we did, and looked for income from other sources as long as you're satisfied with the quality. It's almost wearying to see people expressing surprise at the bond meltdown that happened last year. It was always going to happen, mm-hmm. And it was just a question of minimizing your own investors' exposure to it. Now, having gone through the worst bond bear market that there has ever been historically around the world, people have taken write-downs. It's not to say that there's likely to be a repeat of another bond bear market. It's more likely that there's going to be a kind of trading market where things are flat. One week they'll go one way, another week they'll go another way. This is what you're seeing surrounding the current news headlines. So if you filter out that kind of noise, you go back to the fundamentals of what you think will survive through recessionary or zero growth economic conditions. Mm-hmm. And those are the stocks that have good pricing power, loyal customer bases, and also internal efficiencies. They're also companies that are well capitalized, that don't rely on short-term financing. Mm-hmm. And those are where you really want to be in the portfolio. They're not necessarily traditional value stocks. Value stocks did really well last year, but then again, banks are value stocks on the classic definition. Mm-hmm. It's more a question of quality. And if you go out of that quality and say, well, I'll play some cyclical names, then you want to be somewhere where there is permanent trending demand for a new technology. Mm-hmm. New technology was what survived through the 1990s recession, through the 2008 recession. And as long as you can see now, new technologies are emerging in listed form. Companies that have heavy weightings there are actually surviving this volatility very well.
Okay. So in 2020, you might have had as few bonds as possible. You might have had a bunch of growth stocks, even if they had relied on financing because financing was so cheap. Mm.
If you thought they were cheap enough, you would have had them. Yes, yeah. You wouldn't have necessarily bought them at a very high multiple because after 2020, you got those very, very high price earnings multiples, 23, 24 in the US, above 30 in New Zealand. And that was just a multiple expansion rather than, you know, a proper revaluation based on improving fundamentals. We, at that time, were more interested in the so-called listed real assets, which are infrastructure and diversified real estate, because they have a decent yield and they are not quite as susceptible to consumer, you know, foibles, to consumers putting their pocketbooks away. They're often based on very long-term contracts. Some of them are almost quasi-bond-like. And in infrastructure particularly, where we are heavily weighted still, they have inflation adjustment clauses in their contracts with the government. So they can actually ride out inflation periods quite well without impact on earnings.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. I look at the corporate bond yields sometimes and some have 6-7%, maybe more overseas, I'm not sure, but in New Zealand. Which isn't a huge number, but considering some growth funds sort of target 10% per year, I'm not sure what yours targets, and takes on a lot of risk to do so, sort of 6% on a pretty safe corporate bond feels pretty attractive. Is this a particularly good time to be buying bonds, and do you have a lot of bonds in your portfolios and other investors?
We certainly have more than we had, and that's quite a recent move. We did it at the start of February. We thought at that point there was value back in very selected bond markets. You've got to be careful with bonds because the bond markets around the world are much bigger than the equity markets, just in terms of the money that they're controlling. There are also a huge number of securities, about 28,000 in the main global bond index. So do you really need to hold all of those bonds? You know, some of them are minuscule allocations in the portfolio. So we took a different approach and we went to a specialist manager, internationally Morgan Stanley Investment Management, who did a sustainable portfolio based on other factors that that are useful going forward in the transformation to sustainable energy, for instance. And also, when you look at some of the big bond issuers, the most indebted countries around the world, they are high weights in a bond index. You're forced to buy them if you've got an index-aware fund. We decided we didn't want an index-aware fund in the bond space, because otherwise you are dominated by Japanese, US Treasury, in some indices, Chinese bonds as well. And your capacity to do interesting things around the margin is very limited. So we thought, well, given that the main issue is preserving purchasing power during an inflationary period, and yes, you say the yields are up 6-7% in this fund I'm referring to as well as the ones you've been looking at, you want to buy bonds that have high yields but also have a basic underlying value to society and to where the world is transitioning to once we're through this period of repricing and volatility.
Yeah. And you talked about, you know, the inevitability of the bond bear market back in 2020 because yields were doing what they were doing. What happens when the reverse happens, when inflation comes under control, Reserve Bank and central banks around the world cut their rates? What happens to bond values then? What happens to your bond portfolio when that happens?
Yeah, I think it's very important not to think that the yields are just going to go back down to below, you know, 1% or below 2% as they were historically. First of all, inflation is going to stay a little bit higher for a bit longer. You know, we might be 4%-ish to say 3-4% might be a new normal potentially for inflation. But also the other thing is that what drove that fall in bond yields, and it was the tail end of a 30-year fall in bond yields, was lower inflation, better fiscal management by governments, globalization, factors that were disinflationary. And then in the mid-2010s, it kind of went too far, and everyone got worried about a deflationary debt crisis emerging. And deflationary debt crises are really bad because no one invests, and economies grind to a halt. What we've got now, we're not there yet, but the risk that people are worried about now is an inflationary debt crisis. They don't happen so much in developed countries. Ray Dalio, who some of you may know as a hedge fund manager, but he's also a bit of a thinker and a philosopher on economics, he wrote a series of books called Big Debt Crises. And one of them is about this factor, this inflationary debt crisis. We've got out of control inflation, governments desperately issuing bonds at higher yields to try and cover their outgoings, people trying to get salary rises to keep up with cost of living in this cycle. It's always traditionally been emerging markets that have seen that. The worry for investors now is that developed markets have been skating along the edge of that too, and we have to find a way out of that.
Okay, and you're confident we can do so?
I think it's unresolved, to be perfectly honest. I think it's unresolved. I think the problem is that everyone naturally wants to preserve their purchasing power, every person in an economy. So everyone will ask for salary increases. We had strikes here yesterday, you know, and everyone's basis for asking for those salary increases is always reasonable. Other contracts have inflation adjustments automatically. If you look at things like pensions around the world, many of them are inflation adjusted. So we have that structurally as pushing the purchasing power of people up in nominal terms. Prices will follow those purchasing power gains.
Yeah.
And the trick is not to let that become a deadly upward spiral.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's hard to ask for wage restraint when people are really, really suffering. No one will accept that when there's record tight labour markets around the developed world. Who will accept wage restraint? And yet, down the road, I think we need to adjust to a slightly new environment, because disinflation, falling asset values, is no longer really the main risk. The main risk is that inflation just cannot be put back in its box, and currencies will weaken accordingly.
It's interesting, right? Once you have inflation, someone has to hurt and lose along the way. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's a constant stepladder up.
It is. The danger is you get special sort of rent-seeking behaviour. If inflation gets embedded, then groups in society that have influence can use that influence to get protected from inflation. But not everyone gets that protection.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a mad scramble for who gets the protection from government, you know, sponsors or benefactors. Don't want that developing here.
The sooner it can come down, the better.
Yeah.
I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but 1870 was the previous year that both stocks and bonds fell in the same year. Historically, the whole point of a bond stock portfolio is that they're not correlated.
Yeah.
It feels like they were correlated and had their first cheered fall.
Yeah, it's really good that you mentioned that, actually. Because that's got a couple of implications for portfolio construction. The old balanced portfolio and its variance between moderate or conservative right through to aggressive, it'll be a ratio of fixed interest to equities on the assumption that they rarely move in the same direction at the same time. That's untrue in the last year.
Yeah.
They have begun moving in the same direction at the same time, which is a big, big theoretical and practical challenge to modern portfolio theory. It needs to persist longer for it to be kind of a defeat for that aspect of portfolio construction. But the main thing to bear in mind is you've got to wonder about the time frame. What's your investment horizon? They may be moving together over this month or maybe even a quarter in time. But if you're building for 3 to 5 years, are they still diversified or are they in fact not diversified? Because if they're not, then you need new components in there that don't move in line with, say, the main equity market indices.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of my question, is do you think that correlation will return? Because my understanding is when interest rates fall, the capital value of bonds will actually increase. And if interest rates get cut, stock valuations might go up because discount rates are lower. So could we see, you know, in an environment where inflation does come under control and interest rates do come down, could we see both stocks and bonds go up in correlation and that correlation could be extended?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the funny thing about correlation is people don't complain if it's a positive correlation in an up market, but they complain if it's a positive correlation in a down market. So what you really want over longer term is a negative correlation in all markets, whether up or down, and that builds the long-term wealth. I think with regard to volatility, the lower volatility of bonds on any measure historically means that if you put bonds in a portfolio, it flatters the average volatility of that portfolio. So that's been an incentive to create structures where you dilute the overall volatility by raising the bond allocation, which works until bond volatility goes up. Mm-hmm. And that is actually what we've seen in the last 6 months to a year. There's an index that's run on, you know, the Chicago exchanges, and it's based on derivatives. It's called MOVE Index. It's spiked up to a level that we haven't seen since the GFC. That's not to say the reasons are the same. They're not. It's just the huge swings in interest rates and illiquidity that's building in some of the bond markets, including the US bond market, in sub-segments of the curve, is getting priced in. Now, that's not what you want, because that actually means the bonds are adding to your portfolio volatility rather than diluting it. So you need to be pushing towards other assets that are not as volatile. You can find that, as I said before, in that real asset segment. Mm-hmm. You can also find it in new things like, say, carbon emissions. We have a fund there. There are things related to the environmental transformation generally, and that can go on the forest side. It can go on new forms of agriculture. There are different things that can go into portfolios that are still uncorrelated mm-hmm. with those major asset types. Yep. Yeah,
I think one big fund told me they were buying literal timber.
Yes,
literal timber commodities as an uncorrelated asset.
Yep, that's one example. A year ago, maybe 18 months ago, when there were all those supply chain bottlenecks, people were buying container allocations on ships that weren't actually sailing because the price of containerized shipping was just through the roof. It's come back down now. But, you know, if you're prepared to take the swings, and they can be very huge in those slightly less liquid diversifying assets, then in the longer term, they are actually quite helpful to portfolio construction.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. There was an interesting note in your firm's Global Outlook report, which I really enjoy. It's always worth a read. But it talked about how, you know, prior to 2020, when all markets were going up, partly due to quantitative easing, this bubble we talked about, which eventually formed, you could kind of buy a massive wide range of things and everything was kind of going up. So a lot of indexing, a lot of, you know, portfolios with 1,000 different stocks in it. In your report, you suggested that what might happen over the next few years is that indexes in general might track somewhat sideways while the things in it, some go down, some go up. They're sort of what you call secular rotation.
Yes.
And that if you want to do well during this time, you might have to build a more focused portfolio of the sectors that are doing well, and that sort of more index-style strategies, whether passive or active, might be less successful. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, indexation has its merits in terms of efficiency. No one would deny that. But what happens with indexation is it can become a victim of its own success, because some stocks or sectors become hugely weighted in that index, and then new money into passive, say, funds are required to buy it in the proportion. So you can get, say, you know, information technology peaking at 30% or more of the S&P. That kind of thing happens. And then you get an unwind from that. So if you are prepared to go off index to a degree, then you're freed to pick up long-term compounders where the business model may not necessarily be a huge market capitalization company. It may just have a niche in which it's very, very profitable and, as I said before, has some pricing power. I think that's the critical thing. Or alternatively, has access to a new technology. Now, if you're willing, therefore, to say, I'm going to go off index, then you don't have to wait for the index to deliver its long-term average return. I think that's crucial. When you go to index, you're relying on the index's long-run return. And say with equities, that can be somewhere between 7.5% and 8.5% mm-hmm. for world equities. Some years you'll see nothing like that. Some years you'll see a negative return. If you are prepared to say, I'll go well away from the index, you may never see that 7.5 in any given year, but you will see more positive years because you won't be exposed to those years where some heavily market cap weighted sectors just completely decompress. It's interesting that in what's happening in the banks now, and this won't be, this is not a forecast at all, but before the GFC, banks became a huge part of market capitalization. So index funds at that time were very heavily exposed to banks. Now, before 2020, it was IT that had become the huge part of the index weight. There's nothing wrong with either banks or IT in their place, but, you know, as money flows in, it can be excessive and you get these over-concentrations. Over-concentration risk is what we're navigating at the moment, mm-hmm. and you've got to be highly active to stay away from that.
Yeah. Okay. I guess, yeah, I'm running out of time, but my last question for you might be, you know, in a time of upheaval where things are changing this much and perhaps there's less just general upward momentum in markets, is this a time when active funds should outperform the passive ones? Because passive had a pretty good decade.
Yes, you would expect to see that, Dan. And you are seeing it. There's mm-hmm. evidence that the active managers are doing much better. It's partly skill in terms of avoiding the really dreadful stocks and bonds. And there are many quite dreadful exposures that passive obligations are just required to buy, you know. At the same time, active managers can also, they can access new innovations very quickly before they become widely known. So if you were wanting to look at, say, energy transition, for example, you need to be a specialist. You need to know what the Biden administration is doing in greening the American economy. You need to know what the New Zealand government is doing in issuing green bonds. We just issued in New Zealand our first big government tranche of green bonds. Now, you have to, as an active manager, you can see that coming. As a passive manager, you have to wait for it to have happened and then, you know, react to it afterwards. So you do have that information advantage. You can move quickly into new promising sectors. Mm-hmm. It's probably where active management will add value consistently over the next decade.
Yeah. Okay. And last question, if you had to summarise your expectations in the market for the rest of the year in a sentence or two, how would you summarise your expectations?
Not as bad as they might feel this last week is how I would say. I think there was a great headline that I saw, and I borrow it from John Others, the FT columnist, where he said, it's more of a dilemma than a disaster. I think we are in a dilemma because the central banks do have to put a stopper on inflation, but they don't want to break too many things that are reliant on yields not going through the roof. So it's going to be a year of many dilemmas and policy choices and choppy reversals. It's easy to get whipsawed. So the advice would be don't panic too quickly. Don't trade on current news flows, because by the time the order is implemented in the market, there may have been a complete reversal in sentiment, and you can see that day to day or hour to hour in some markets at the moment. So very, very choppy, but be satisfied with the quality and the underlying balance sheet of anything you invest in. Just be very, very vigilant about that one.
Yeah, it feels like we're at the end or near the end of the interest rate shock, which will be a relief when that's behind, I suppose. Greg, thank you so much for coming on and talking us through it.
Great pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
And thank you, everyone at home, for listening. This has been Of Interest Podcast, and we'll see you next week.